Welcome. Thank you for standing by. Throughout today's conference, all participants will remain in listen-only mode. During the Q&A portion of the call, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn your conference over to Brady Phillips. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call. It's part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, businesses, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA's Communications in Washington and Silver Spring, and I'll be facilitating the call today. During the call, we'll have three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session, and a copy of the presentation can be downloaded in the following website, www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. And it's also on the NOAA.gov media advisory if you couldn't understand that. Our first presenter today is Jay Crouch. He's a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information in Asheville. We'll provide a summary of the May U.S. climate report and the drought monitor released today. The next presenter is Billy Sweet, an oceanographer located at NOAA's Center for Oceanographic Products and Services in Silver Spring, Maryland. And he'll talk about high tide flooding over the last year and provide insight as to what we can expect in the coming year. And our final presentation is Brad Pugh, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland, who will provide the latest El Nino update as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks over the coming 3 months. Our first speaker will be Jay Crouch from Asheville. Jay?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I want to start off speaking to slide number two on the slide deck you can download from our website. Just a note, I will not be discussing our May global temperature statistics. That report will be released on Monday. So we'll start off talking about contiguous U.S. Temperatures during 2017. The three maps you can see there, the first one on the left are May temperatures. The map in the middle is spring temperatures, and the map on the right are year-to-date temperatures for January through May. I'm going to start off talking about May. May was a pretty slow month in terms of temperatures across the lower 48. We had multiple slow-moving systems, weather systems that moved across the country. Ahead of those storm systems, we saw above-average temperatures, and behind those systems, we saw below-average temperatures. And when we averaged the temperatures for the month, most locations had near-average temperatures. A couple of departures from average, we did see above-average temperatures along the West Coast and parts of the Southeast, where Florida was particularly warm, where they've been dealing with drought. And we did see below-average temperatures across parts of the South Central U.S., with fairly cold temperatures in the lower Mississippi River Valley. I will note in the Midwest into the Northeast, where we saw near-average temperatures, that part of the country was fairly wet. So we saw below-average daytime temperatures and above-average nighttime temperatures, and when we averaged that together, it ended up being a near-average month. Looking at spring, spring was fairly warm, so this is the period March through May. It was the eighth warmest spring for the lower 48. As you can see on the map, most locations were warmer than average, with really warm conditions across much of the Rockies, stretching into the southwest southern plains, and then into the southeast in the mid-Atlantic. Much of the warmth that we saw during the spring season came during April and May, during April and March, with the May near-average temperatures bringing the seasonal average down somewhat. Looking at the year-to-date, January through May, it's been our second warmest year-to-date so far for the lower 48. We did see record warmth across parts of the southwest southern plains and into the southeast, with many locations from the Rockies to the East Coast experiencing much above-average temperatures. The exception to that was the northwest, where we saw below-average temperatures for much of Washington into Oregon, and Washington State was the only state in the lower 48 that had below-average temperatures for the first 5 months of the year. Moving on to slide number three to look at precipitation for 2017. Once again, on the left, we have a map for May. The middle map is for spring, and the map on the right is for the year-to-date. 2017 has been a fairly wet month for many locations across the lower 48. and that was true for May as well. We did see above average precipitation for much of the east, with record precipitation across parts of the central Appalachians. We did see below average precipitation across much of the southern plains and in the northeast, in the northern plains. And you'll notice that dryness in the northern plains, it extends back multiple time periods back to spring and the year to date. And I'll get to that more in a moment. Looking at the spring season, March through May, that was the 11th wettest spring on record for the lower 48. We had above average precipitation in the northwest, with near record and record precipitation across the mid-Mississippi River Valley, where we saw significant flooding in early May and late April. And that heavy precipitation extended further to the east across the Midwest, Northeast, and parts of the central Appalachians. And backing out, looking at the year-to-date, it's been our fourth wettest year so far, looking at January through May. And if you notice, there was record and near-record high precipitation across much of the west. And that record high precipitation in the Sierra Nevadas in California really helped contribute to the improvement of drought in that part of the country. And we also saw that above-average precipitation across parts of the central plains stretching into the northeast. And in addition to the dryness in the northern plains, Florida has been fairly dry for the January through May period. But we did see drought expand rapidly during the first part of the year, but recent precipitation has helped drought improve there. They've been dealing with a lot of impacts in terms of impacts on agriculture as well as large wildfires burning across the state. Moving on to slide number four, my last slide I will be speaking to. This is the U.S. Drought Monitor report that came out this morning. 7.3% of the lower 48 is in drought, and this is down about 2.5% since early April. We did see drought improve across parts of the central and southern plains, the southeast, and the northeast. If you notice, there's no D3 on the drought or extreme drought. This is the first time since May 2010 that we haven't had D3 drought anywhere in the contiguous U.S. So if we think back, it was the summer of 2010 where we had the drought really explode in the southern plains, with Texas and Oklahoma experiencing extreme drought. And those that D3 drought has persisted somewhere in the U.S. until the past couple of weeks. We did see drought conditions worsen across the northern plains, as I mentioned, where we've had dryness back several months. And so we can see that abnormally dry conditions are also developing in the Midwest and parts of the central plains. This is important going into the growing season, and this is concerns with drying soils and other impacts that might agricultural impacts that might develop. And with that, I will pass it off to Billy.
Great. Good morning. My name is William Sweet, and I will talk briefly about some 2016, what we saw in terms of high tide flooding, and give some outlooks for 2017. To start with, high tide flooding in the United States, as we are describing it here, are coastal flood events that are ocean-related. Locally, they exceed the National Weather Service threshold for minor impacts. Basically, water is reaching the brim locally, oftentimes spilling over old seawalls, flooding low areas of roads, and backing up into stormwater systems, infiltration, and actually surfacing sometimes in away from the ocean, but in sort of these urban environments. Due to sea level rise, the flood frequencies over time have been rapidly increasing, oftentimes linearly or quadratic, meaning accelerating, which is the case in several cities in the East Coast and Gulf Coast. 300 upwards of 1,000% increase in the last 50 years. The elevations as to which I'll talk about vary by location, either due to mitigative strategies already in place, like in Texas, if there's a large seawall for hurricanes, or it could just depend upon local topography. But already seasonal high tides and even minor wind events, or really no wind event at all, are actually now capable of causing high tide flooding, whereas decades ago they required a much stronger storm. So we can see this rapid sort of skyrocketing increase around the country is what's shown in the figure. Slide six. With development of El Nino, there's patterns, so not any given year is going to be what exactly is the trend. In this case, our trends are definitely changing, so we don't really have a normal as to make that comparison as we might in temperature or rain, which is maybe a little more gradual. Here's an example from Norfolk, Virginia tide gauge, sort of showing what I'm referring to in terms of a quadratic or an accelerating trend, a statistical trend that we fit in the green line. The blue would be the number of days per year with an exceedance. So it's just a snapshot of one station that was at the earlier slide. And we can see that during El Nino, you tend to really have a compounding effect. You tend to get more events, either due to changing in weather patterns, more storms on the East Coast or prevailing winds on the West Coast. You tend to get higher water. So sort of East and West Coast. This year, looking out, there is a chance of a mild El Nino developing, and so that's what we actually show in terms of the 2017 projection for Norfolk. If indeed one does occur, it's potential to have upwards of a 35% increase above what we would expect due to the underlying trend increase from sea level rise. Next slide, please. On seven, so what happened in 2016? We broke two all-time records in Savannah and Charleston, 50 days in Charleston, 38 days in Savannah. These are areas, Charleston especially, that's undertaking some large major urban infrastructure stormwater systems to clear roadways that are experiencing a lot of sunny day flooding. Key West tied their all-time record with 14 days. In 2016, the trends that as they keep inching upwards are really actually accelerating in lots of places. On average, we're 130% higher than they were about 20 years ago. So this is really within a lifetime of our youth and within a mortgage cycle. Again, the flooding, when we look at these dots here, where it's highest on the mid-Atlantic and some areas in the southeast, tend to be higher where you have lower thresholds. So where you're more susceptible to flooding, let's say at a foot above mean, the high tide line, you tend to have more than if you're in an area that you don't get susceptible to flooding until 2 or 3 feet if you have a storm wall in place. So Galveston or St. Petersburg shown here didn't really have much. It really requires a significant storm to flood. Though the back bays might start flooding, and once you locally get away from these areas, you might have a very different story. Slide 8, when we look to 2017, using a multi-model ensemble of what might form in terms of El Nino, there is a possibility, though our next speaker will discuss that, if in case a mild El Nino would form, we could expect on the East Coast and West Coast, where historically there has been some sensitivity to El Nino, and this is only the areas that we are able to provide the sort of historical characterization as we look forward. We could have somewhere between 15 and upwards of 35% increase above what we'd expect from growing due to sea level rise itself. So we will monitor this and report back next year. So that's it, and I'll pass it over to Brad.
Yeah, thanks, Billy. Good morning, everybody. This is Brad Pugh at the Climate Prediction Center. And slide 9 is the sea surface temperatures and ENSO forecast. In the upper left-hand corner is the average sea surface temperature anomalies for the period May 14th through June 10th. And it shows above normal sea surface temperatures throughout the central and eastern equatorial Pacific. One important note, though, the upper ocean heat anomaly has decreased during the past month. Also have above normal sea surface temperatures throughout the tropical Atlantic. Considering the state of the ocean, both at the surface but at depth below the surface, and atmospheric indicators, we have ENSO neutral conditions present, given both the ocean and atmosphere. The lower left-hand corner is updated CPC IRI official forecast. Chances for El Nino development have decreased from the previous outlook issued in mid-May. As I mentioned previously, the heat content anomaly of the upper ocean has decreased over the past month, and we haven't really seen the atmosphere coupled to the ocean, haven't seen enhanced convection develop near the dateline, which you would expect in a developing El Nino. So checking out the probabilities for El Nino and ENSO neutral conditions during JAS, the next three-month time period, you can see ENSO neutral conditions are favored 50 to 55%. Chances for El Nino are still slightly elevated during the next 3 months. But you'll note as we move into the fall and winter months, the chances of El Nino development are very similar to the what we'd expect looking at climatology. The single red line here is very close to the red bar. So, and also note the La Nina, the blue bar, the probabilities are very low, much lower than climatology. So a repeat of La Nina is unlikely in 2017. All right, moving to the next slide, which is the July temperature and precipitation probability forecast. During July, CPC is calling for increased chances of above normal temperatures across the majority of the continental U.S., with the highest probabilities across the southwest U.S., and above-normal temperatures are also favored for Alaska. July precipitation forecast shows increased chances for above-median precipitation across the western Gulf Coast region, also parts of the northern Rockies, northern High Plains, with below-median precip favor just to the south of there across the central Rockies and Great Basin. And above median precipitation is favored for southwest Alaska and the Aleutians. And these forecasts will be updated at the end of June, the July forecast. Next slide, 11, is the seasonal outlook, July, August, September. Forecasting enhanced odds for above normal temperatures across nearly all of the continental U.S., although equal chances for below, near, above temperatures are forecast across parts of Montana. The highest odds for above normal temperatures are forecast for the Northeast, Florida, and the southwestern U.S. And across Alaska, above normal temperatures are favored. And precipitation during the July, August, September time period calls for a slight tilt in the odds for above median precipitation across the western Gulf Coast region, also the northern Great Plains, and also southwest Alaska and the Aleutians. And the final slide, number 12, the seasonal drought outlook. We've seen a big improvement in the drought across Florida due to very heavy rainfall the past couple of weeks. Marco Islands received 20 inches of rain just in the first 13 days of June. So any lingering drought across the Florida Peninsula and South Georgia is likely to end perhaps as early as next week or in the early part of July. The seasonal outlook calling for increased chances of above precip and a fairly wet climatology favors drought improvement across eastern Montana, the Dakotas, northern Minnesota. And a wet climatology with the summer monsoon rainfall favors drought removal across Arizona, southwest New Mexico, with a dry climatology favoring a continuation of long-term drought across any remaining drought areas of California. There is a small area of drought that developed over southwest Alaska recently. It's a fairly wet climatology July, August, September, so we would expect that drought to to end across Alaska during the next 3 months. And that's all from CPC. Turn it back to Brady.
Great. Thanks, Brad. We'll now take specific questions from the call participants. And again, please be sure to clearly indicate who you'd like to answer the question, if at all possible. Operator, can you remind everyone how they can queue up a question and queue up the first call then? Thanks.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and please check to be sure that your line is unmuted and record your name when prompted. Our first question comes from Seth Borenstein from the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I guess this is for Brad. While we were actually on hold, Columbia and IRI put out their June 15th ENSO model, which is quite a bit different than the one you're using, and hikes El Nino in the fall and beginning of early winter to about the same in OND and almost the same in NDJ and DJF. Have you seen this? Is there a trend in, if you look back, is there a trend more toward increasing? Or, I mean, it looks like it was decreasing, now the trend is back to increasing. Is this just totally one of these, hell if we know what's going to go on with El Nino? Or, you know, and does it also mean that whatever we get is going to be so mild it doesn't matter?
Yeah. Hey, Seth. I haven't seen that latest forecast that came out this morning. The latest what I've seen, and this was slide 9, was showing the most likely outcome would be ENSO neutral conditions during the fall and winter. And we haven't seen the atmosphere respond to the above normal sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific this spring. And as I noted, the upper ocean heat content anomaly, if you go from the surface down to 100 to 200 meters below the surface, those anomalies have rapidly decreased over the past month, I believe as much as 50%. I'll have to check out the IRI forecast you're referencing. I haven't seen that yet.
Okay, just to follow up, if you don't mind,
sure.
The last few years with ENSO, we had the almost El Nino that didn't become an El Nino, and then when it did become an El Nino, it became very big, and then the La Nina that barely existed. Is something going on with the ENSO pattern in the last 5-10 years that's different than we've seen, or is this just we're getting a better, we're concentrating more on it and we're understanding it a little bit more somewhat?
Yeah, as far as like the frequency, I'm not aware of any changes in the frequency of ENSO or El Nino.
Or just changes in magnitudes or whatever. No big changes you're seeing. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, you're welcome.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name at the prompt. Again, star 1. Please check to be sure that your line is unmuted and record your name at the prompt.
Okay, I'm going to put out the final call or any follow-up questions or final call, star 1. Or I will conclude the call. So while folks are thinking about if they have a question, I'll just begin the process of just reminding people about some upcoming. We do have a question. Oh, operator, can you queue up the next person?
We have Patricia Kitchen with Newsday New York. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much. This usually doesn't happen. There's only one question, so I'm usually holding off until to see if somebody else addressed the ones that I had. But so a question about if there's expectations for no El Nino, Brad, how would that affect hurricane, you know, expectations for hurricane season?
Yeah, the outlook that was released a couple of weeks ago, late May, was calling for a 45% chance of above normal season across the Atlantic,
uh-huh.
35% of a near normal season, and a 20% chance of a below normal season.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't that...
If El Nino didn't develop, that would perhaps favor a more active hurricane season.
Uh-huh. So if it didn't develop, it would favor more active?
Yes. Typically, El Nino suppresses, reduces the number of tropical cyclones across the Atlantic basin.
Right. So I guess I'm confused. If it doesn't develop, wouldn't that mean that it would favor more active?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. I get you. So
I mean, there's there's other factors, but
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So if it doesn't develop, then so it could be more towards that, like what you were saying, a 45% for above normal, right? That it could be leaning more in that direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the update that was released
sure.
on May,
right.
May, yep. May 25th.
Uh-huh. Okay. And also I have some questions for Billy about coastal flooding. I'm brand new to coastal flooding here, so I hope you'll appreciate that. So am I right? I read the report, actually, that you had the link to earlier about the minor high tide flooding. And am I right that you were saying that, you know, is expected to become more serious, disruptive, and costly, what you had been describing, that kind of flooding?
Absolutely. So this is William Sweet. As you can see from the example of Norfolk, but we can pull out any of the Northeast sites as well. They've rapidly been increasing due to sea level rise, and in many of the locations on the East Coast, particularly the Mid-Atlantic, that it's characterized as a accelerating trend, meaning it's sort of growing in leaps and bounds. It's not a gradual change
right,
in the number
exactly,
of days
yeah.
per year. And so what right. tends to be the problem is sometimes the impacts are very minor to begin with, but then there are areas like Atlantic City and Norfolk, Charleston, Miami, where the water then really starts surfacing and becomes problematic. Once the impacts become noticeable, and mm-hmm. communities realize, wow, there's something going on here. That just means that it's more likely to get chronic rather quickly due to
right.
the fact that it's
yeah.
this accelerating on an annual basis.
Right. Well, seeing you had mentioned pulling out, you could pull out examples. I'm especially interested in Montauk, Long Island,
okay.
and Kings Park. Could you give me I tried to kind of figure out from the report what was being said. It looked to me, though, that for 2016, there were fewer incidents of that kind of flooding than in 2015.
Yeah, that's right. You do get sort of regional variability from
right.
year to year, kind of bumps around. In the Northeast
right.
last year was not as active, let's say, in terms of you always have the repeat of the seasonal tides themselves, but maybe the prevailing winds were slightly different last year than years
yeah.
prior.
Uh-huh.
It really had a big increase in 2009, 2010, 2011, and then it seemed
okay,
to subside for a few years.
To 2011, then, okay, subside. Okay.
As the tides go, everything kind of ebb and flows, but unfortunately the baseline as to which they're ebbing and flowing, the number of times per year, is still uh-huh. rapidly increasing. So you may have a reprieve for a few years.
Can you just say that again, please, as the baseline as to where...
The baseline as to which we measure the frequency of these events will ebb and flow. The number of events per year will sort of ebb and flow about this baseline. The problem is this baseline
right,
is
yeah.
itself rapidly increasing. So you may have a reprieve for a few years where
right,
sea
right.
levels, winds are a certain direction for longer, or ocean currents were a certain
right,
pattern,
sure.
but that would not be expected to be the case as you move forward
right,
as
sure.
characterized
yeah.
through the past.
And this baseline would be sort of what, how would you describe what the baseline is? That's the point where if it goes over this line, then it's a flood, as opposed to if it stays at this line, then it isn't?
Well, my usage of baseline a moment ago was really the number of events per year you could expect, or number of days.
Number of events, okay.
But that's directly tied to the baseline as to what mean sea level is doing. And mean sea level will vary year to year, but it is increasing throughout the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic and much of the United States. And what that actually does is it decreases the freeboard, or the gap between sea level and our infrastructure, such that more typical tides and you know, less extreme storms now are really starting to become more impactful, whereas decades ago when sea level was lower, it really would have required a much more significant of event to cause that kind of impact.
Could you speak, too, to the outlook here for Montauk and Kings Point? What is it that you're...
Well, so Kings Point, the outlook would be 19, roughly 20 of these. And again, the elevations are slightly different than Montauk would, slightly different topography there. Flooding requires a little bit additional height of water. There, we're really sort of five or under events that we would expect. Part of its topography, where you're located, Kings Point tends to be in a little bit more of an exposed, or excuse me, sort of an area where the wind can really cause water to pile up, because it's more sort of in point, where Montauk is more exposed on a point, and its water doesn't pile up there as well.
And if you have other questions, please.
Yeah, this is Brady.
Okay.
If you have additional, like, specific questions, I will connect you with Billy, so just send me an email.
That would be great. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. If there were questions in line, forgive me. Go ahead. Thank you.
Operator, next question. Thanks.
Next, we have John Boyer with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Your line is open.
Hi there. My question is for Brad, and it's about the seasonal precipitation outlooks. I believe in some previous years I've seen outlooks with enhanced odds for extra rain in the southeastern Gulf Coast with an expectation of tropical activity or linked to that. Can you speak to this year and what kind of signals you would need to see, or what kind of confidence level you would have to start anticipating higher than normal odds for above normal precipitation on the southeast coast or in that region?
Yeah, the what you see in the July, August, September outlook, the strongest signal for wetness for above median precip was across the Western Gulf Coast region, based on our model guidance. Across the southeastern U.S., the model guidance was conflicting, so it was. That was the basis for the equal chances for below, near, or above precip for that region. So right now there's not a strong climate signal for precipitation across the southeastern U.S. We'll have to see how that plays out the next month or two.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep. You're welcome.
And if you would like to ask a question, as a reminder, please press star 1 and record your name at the prompt. Again, star 1 and record your name at the prompt.
Okay, if there are no further questions, I'll wrap up the call. Again, thank you to all of our speakers for taking the time to give their presentations and answer questions, and to everyone else for participating in the call. And a couple of calendar updates for the coming month. Hard to believe we're already looking at July, but the June U.S. climate highlights will be released on July 7th, and the June global climate highlights will be released on June 18th. Just as a reminder, the May global highlights will be released this coming Monday at 11 a.m. And our next monthly call is planned for July 20th at 11 a.m. Finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA Media Advisory that announced this call within 60 to 90 minutes. In the meantime, if you do have further information needs, please email myself, brady.phillips@noah.gov, or my colleague, John Leslie, that's john.leslie@noah.gov, and we'll find out how we can answer your questions. This concludes the call. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for your participation today. You may disconnect your lines at this time.